Welcome to Tactical Permaculture. I've worked on projects ranging from the poorest to richest clients, from inner cities to suburbs to farmlands to remote wilderness, from the eco-war front lines to celebrity backyards. In over 25 years of service to the earth and the community of life, I've learned that in the fight for sustainable survival, growing is half the battle. Please go to tacticalpermaculture.com to read my blog, watch my videos, view my photos, access web applications, and click on the join membership link to access exclusive features. March 22nd, 2024, episode 119. This is more of a philosophical show. I want to get a bit life historical and talk about some lessons I've learned being deeply rooted in various, broadly speaking, various anti-authoritarian movements, very extreme anti-authoritarian movements, where it wasn't just a nihilism or just sort of a empty and negative rejection of power and authority, but in the context of fighting for causes that within movements or within small groups, our mission and purpose was to fight for or against one or often many things and try to organize without coercion, without intimidation, at best without manipulation, but most importantly without authoritarianism. And there was great effort put into identifying and dismantling hierarchical systems of thought and leadership and influence of all kinds. That was the primary objective, was to accept the limitations of what could be accomplished within the context of making authoritarianism such a taboo that only the most shadowy sort of subliminal aspects of being a type A personality or a natural charismatic leader, those traits would emerge, and they would rise within groups, within communities, within campaigns. And often there was enough pressure from a sneering peanut gallery of people who did not want to see the opportunism of what you might call predatory leadership, people who are doing it for self-aggrandizement and with an excess of egotism. So it was always a attempt to find a balance, a healthy balance between looking up to people and mentoring people and taking on responsibility and being founders and starting projects and inviting people into them, but doing so in a way that had awareness and self-critical awareness about not taking it too far and not being taking too much of the spotlight. I think for the most part it was effective and it was good training, and it was always a trade-off. By giving up control, there's only so much you can do when you are in command. That's the way I want to frame this, is commanding without control, and what that has meant in my life, how that what the trade-offs have been, and when and where that's ideal and where it fails. And I would say it's been pointed out before that consensus decision-making, where everyone has an equally powerful vote and anyone can veto, essentially, because if you have if you've made a consensus to only make decisions collectively by consensus, then you're going to spend a lot of time in meetings, you're going to spend a lot of time politicking with each other. And but the value of that, of course, is that negotiation and compromise has to occur to the point where everyone is equally dissatisfied, if not equally satisfied at the outcome, because if anyone can be the stinker who derails what would otherwise be the majority rule, then someone who's having a bad day or just has a bad attitude or is the one who constantly blocks things to get attention, which often happens, you're left at the mercy under that system of the most pathological people. I've seen that work. I've seen it be problematic. And what I'm interested in is developing the skills to practice leadership, certainly natural leadership, meaning you didn't go to some leadership training camp. You just happened to be a more sociable, outgoing, charming, charismatic, articulate, passionate individual who other people are inspired by and maybe look up to, and you're just confident, whether it's with a clipboard or back in the day it would be a clipboard, a bullhorn, or just being creative and having the time and the energy to initiate interesting endeavors and have people understand and want to join forces. But not everybody, a lot of people are shy, a lot of people are introverted, but they have gifts and they want to share them. They just don't want to be in the spotlight. So for me, in my journey, it's been a lot of, I would say, discovering wisdom pathways within rebellion, so you're not replicating the systems that you're trying to dismantle. And I've had experiences where my leadership and my command was very organic and very intrinsic to the fact that I was taking on disproportionate responsibility financially and legally and logistically, everything, all the above, just being the project lead or the team leader. People would defer to me. I would make final decisions because I had raised the money or I was in charge of the budget. And even though I would be very open and flexible and inviting to input and feedback and collective decision making, there would still be a deference to my taking the lead. And it was the times where I was the most responsible. Is probably the best word for it. There have been a number of circumstances where, whether it's just leading a training workshop for a day or a weekend, or things for me at the scale of booking and financing and organizing and very always with help and always in the context of teamwork, but taking on very, again, disproportionate responsibility for things like a number of national tours around the U.S., mostly in the form of playing music to raise funds, raise consciousness for political, social, ecological issues. So having a very purpose-driven, very purposeful narrative and theme and gathering people together in what would otherwise be an outlet for cathartic aggression entertainment in that kind of music genre that I was in for most of my life, but developing it and organizing it so that at the end of a concert, let's say, you've done a lot of, brought people there early and do a little film festival and have training, skill shares, workshops, distributing literature and movement building within the context of being a touring musician. That's what I did for most of my life. And it wasn't like proselytizing or even preaching to the converted. Most of the people in those more extreme music scenes, if you will, were very, very much on a warrior path and were very receptive to learning things and being aficionados of do-it-yourself skills. And so it was just for those who were serious about fighting back, whatever that meant. We just had a voracious appetite for information and certainly for solidarity and for fighting back and having each other's backs while we do it, and just building skills and enhancing our abilities and fighting through a lot of drama, a lot of internal fissures in sectarianism. But in that, with that as my main sort of background experience of not being, for me, yes, I've run nonprofits, I've run for-profits, I've done things mainly alone, but most of the time I've done them in groups and in teams, and sometimes I've been voluntarily under the command but not the control of other leaders, other natural leaders in their projects, where I would be volunteering on their behalf of what they started and what they're in charge of. And I learned a lot as a volunteer about the dynamic of not being able to be bossed around, because if you're treated poorly, you're leaned on or you're pressured, you're not even getting paid, you're just going to leave. So there's a lot to learn both leading groups of volunteers and training for that responsibility and that power by doing a lot of volunteer work. So I would say that's probably the best pathway to develop the skills that I'm exploring here. There's a lot of gratitude, a lot of the social skills of expressing gratitude and reading people, understanding what their gifts and what their limitations are, and bringing out the best in people in a manner that makes them feel valued and makes them very much invigorated to be showing up for what you're doing. I would say I've been blessed because for so many years that I took on leadership roles and was looked to for instructions and direction, and in that anti-authoritarian sense, it was a form of command, but I did not control anyone, because although I have hired people mostly later in my life, having a budget to hire people, most of the time we all did what we did on a shoestring budget, if with any budget at all. Very seldom was there ever any excess funds other than just what it took to barely show up or barely pay rent on a space, community space and whatnot. So yeah, there wasn't that temptation to say, oh well, I'm paying you so I can treat you poorly and I can vent and project and do all the things that bosses do in their shadow. And I've had great employers who brought out the best in me and made me respect more than fear them, so that I knew when I wasn't giving my best, and I policed myself and I commanded myself, because I wanted to remain in good standing, not just to keep the job, but more importantly to keep the mutual respect and friendship of employers who I believed in and who I didn't want to let them down. That's been a blessing. I certainly had, I don't say anyone who's been terrible. I don't feel like I even resent any of the people who I have worked for, and that's a blessing that I feel that way. They're on a continuum, but I would say I've been proud to serve a number of employers where, well, I've had, yeah, I guess I don't want to say I resent them, but I've had people who brought out the best in me and people who just turned me into what they call a clock watcher, somebody who just wants to get through the day and does not want to give extra effort. So I know I've had my fair share of knowing the difference and having that contrast of what it means to be a leader who brings the best out of people by showing them respect and with very subtle, hopefully not passive aggressive, but having the tact to have the conversations that are critical around the woodshed, meaning avoiding humiliating people when they make mistakes in front of others. That's probably the most damaging thing, because I think we could all take being yelled at in private better than being, even in a calmer sense, being humiliated in front of others. There's something far more damaging and wounding to the psyche and the sort of self-esteem within a group when there's that kind of shaming, and certainly that happens a lot in more cult-like environments. But I think every hierarchical situation is a cult by the most purest basic definition. It's definitely my fear. And there are people who have said to me at times where I was in those leadership roles, the people who were the most sort of nihilistic about anything being organized, I would say I was unfairly judged at times because of taking on leadership roles. And but I took that to heart. If that criticism was laid, I wanted to know how and why and what I need to do to course correct. I know there was one incident that I regret, where it was a little bit too Tyler Durden-ish in terms of judging someone's behavior, and they really meant no harm. And I feel like I was excessive in my reprimand to something they did that was not even barely an honest, I mean, just is basically, if anything, an honest mistake. But that was rare. It was rare for me to do that. But if you do that even one time, that's what you get remembered for, because all eyes are on you. And I don't want to say it's like crabs in a barrel, but I'll say, if you're from where I come from, where leadership is often frowned upon and people would rather, some people would rather just criticize other people for trying to lead because they're comfortable with the status quo of being in the ghetto of their political ideology, which is prides itself on being anti-authoritarian but doesn't get much done because of that. So there's haters and hecklers and the peanut gallery and whatnot. And I'd say they have a role because, like I said, for me, whoever was looking in from the outside, they probably heard hyperbolic tellings of stories where I was leading at my worst, which I would like to think wasn't often, but like I said, that's what happens. You ask for that extra tension and you better be ready for it. And some people, they bite off more than they can chew and they end up being eaten alive by their own. They eat their own. They cancel culture, all that stuff. That was a thing before social media. Back in my day, people had a voracious appetite for bringing down their own heroes. I would say that they would take twice as much delight in tearing apart the same person or people that they helped build up, just because of, I would say that's my form of nihilism, or my form of, not nihilism, but my form of cynicism, is that sadly you try to please everyone, you try to make everyone feel included, but those who feel for some reason marginalized, whether it's your fault or their fault or someone else's fault, it's the leaders who get blamed for the dysfunction of people who are not in the spotlight. And if you, and this is just kind of going off in a direction of exploring the nuance of, if you were literally from the communities I came from, we would believe in flat organizational political structures, meaning no bosses, no commanders other than ourselves showing up to fit in how we see fit and give no more than we're willing to give, and be ready and prepared to walk away if we don't 100% agree with the direction of every decision minute by minute. And there's pride to be taken in that, but again, something that was said that makes a lot of sense is you don't want the fire department to show up to put out a fire at your house and for him to sit down in a circle on your lawn and have a consensus meeting about how they're going to fight the fire. No, there has to be a chain of command in high stakes, life and death situations. And that has to be based on a word that I felt kinship with, which is meritocracy, meaning there's room for certain forms of earned authority and certain types of hierarchy where it's not dynastic, it's not who's got the most money and who's got the most social capital. It's not about nepotism, it's not about tyranny, dictatorship. It's about people look up to people who have more experience in a field and who have the credentials to back that. That's a very healthy and very natural form of, you might call it, eldership as well. It's not always true that elders within a group have the most experience. It could be the most highly trained, and that could be the youngest person, depending on the situation. Certainly in medical situations, if you have an elderly person who is not a first responder and a young person who is a first responder, it's obvious what that meritocracy looks like. So I'm very comfortable acknowledging that and working with that and framing organizational dynamics within that meritocratic system. And I know people who come from my background who have become first responders, and they would be able to speak directly about what it's like to fall into a chain of command without having your ideology chafed, because you respect the importance of the risks and the dangers. So for me, in the leadership roles that I've taken, I've got to be not just aware of myself, but aware of the safety and the risks that others that I'm taking responsibility for. It does require sacrifice and selflessness to put others, to be aware of others' needs and be aware of what you are asking people to do that could be dangerous. And so, yeah, for me, I spend a lot of time when I do workshops and teaching, which I've done a lot of throughout my life, not so much over the last few years where it's been very much a lone wolf operation, but my modus operandi had always been to go to a lot of workshops and do a lot of volunteering and then apply that training to be able to organize groups to do tasks that could be very dangerous, required a lot of care, whether it's working with tools and equipment, sharp objects, heavy objects, tasks that require care with cadence so people don't injure each other or themselves, and having to be a conductor of a job site or a project site, administer first aid and make sure people's safety needs are front and center, running facilities and having first aid kits and making sure people have plenty of shade and hydration and are doing the task in a safe manner. They're aware of the hazards of the site. And I've done the due diligence to create liability waivers, not just to cover my own liability, but to give people informed consent about what hazards are involved in the activity. And often when you're working outdoors and doing permaculture training, a lot of things can go wrong. One time one of my best, most loyal volunteers unfortunately was more than any of the rest of us was extremely susceptible to poison oak and got it just all over. And it travels. You could get it in one place, it could travel through your body on its own. Not that it's sentient and moving consciously, but because it's so, the oils are so absorbent by the flesh that it'll travel through the body's natural systems, and it got everywhere on this poor fellow. And certain things that are beyond your control, certainly if anyone gets injured under your command or your watch, it's harrowing, to say the least. And you'd be lucky not to get sued a lot of the time. That's what those waivers are for. But yeah, it wasn't the biggest fear for me over all those years, the litigiousness of people who would want to, even though you have your best intentions, if you are responsible for some kind of negligence and someone gets hurt, that could be your entire career. That could end your career. That could destroy your reputation. That could destroy whatever wealth you've been trying to build. Most of my life, I had no wealth. All I had was my reputation. I did care about that, but it would have been futile to sue me because I had no assets. Now that I have my own land and a couple of assets and a little bit of savings, if you will, I'm very risk averse, and I would say it's all about less is more. If I teach and train and have responsibility for and command without control, anyone else, probably for the rest of my life, is going to be, it has been and will continue to be under a new paradigm personally for myself, where I wouldn't do what I used to do, which was a lot of open to the public meetups where there would be a list of do's and don'ts and what you need to bring, and there'd be liability waivers, but it was always rolling the dice. And there would be people who were kind of like meetup trolls before social media made it so that you didn't have to come out and do anything. But back in the early days, Web 2.0, if you will, there would be meetup trolls, and they would come to show up to project hostile vibes and be hypercritical and just be negative. And that was a whole skill set to manage that. I would say I was lucky that I wasn't exposed to much of it, but it does happen. And it was just, you had to roll the dice because you had to be a teacher, you had to make a little bit of money, you had to pay some bills. And you wanted to let people in on a sliding scale as well. You know, I was always trying to be down to earth with prices and whatnot to not price people out. But then you have this paradox where if you price people out and you charge more, then you get people who are probably a little bit more successful in life and therefore probably have a lot to lose or something to lose, to where they're just less likely to be a menace, whereas you get the riffraff, which I'm one of, but I'm a well-behaved member of the riffraff sector. But those who are not, if it's cheap enough for them to get in and they can come in and troll, they can come in and turn your event into a dating game meat market. I mean, that's another problem. They're not necessarily trolling anybody, but they could be there and they could be making women uncomfortable because they're hitting on everybody. You know, and what do you do then? You have to intervene at some level. You can't turn your back on the responsibility you have to keep people safe from each other within groups. That's an awkward, awkward dynamic for sure. And you don't want to take that too far. You don't want to, I mean, you want people to socialize. You want people to feel romantic about what they're doing. So all these, you know, nuanced, very delicate. Some branch of social science deals with the idea that when you're adults, working with other adults, even if you are clearly the leader or commander, the sort of, at least in certain cultures, I would say definitely in what you might call Western culture, although I don't like that word that much, but the idea that even if you technically don't have to, we kind of do all feel obliged to say our pleases and our thank yous, and when issuing direction to other adults, it's not so much in a parental context, or if it's children and adults, it's not expected that there be, it's definitely more effective, I think we all know, to respect someone's humanity by saying the please and thank yous. But it's interesting, once it's all adults in an environment, no one wants to be commanded without those buffers. And there's lots of interesting nuance to that. I remember having boss isn't the right word, but I worked for a client, and if I consider myself, I was independent contractor working for a client, they're the client, they're not your boss. You're the boss because it's your own enterprise. They're the client, and there's a different, and I think a much healthier dynamic there. They can get mad at you, they can yell at you, they can tell you what to do things, but at least you know I'm the boss. I can fire my client and work with other clients who I but it's about being independent, but that's another story. But this one gentleman who was my client, who I was contracting for, he had his vision and he knew what he wanted to direct me to do, but it was charming and endearing how he would always find a way to leave room for my input by saying, everything was, maybe we should do this, maybe we should do that. And there's ways to be very passive aggressive about it, like in the office when he's like, yeah, I'm going to need you to come in on Saturday, okay? And yeah, so it's like this schmuck, schmooze kind of passive-aggressive way to flex your authority, and really you're not giving it an option. But there's an insinuation of that, and it's really just kind of, it's just kind of twisted in a way. But for people who are tactful and well-intentioned, like this gentleman I'm referring to, there was a tone of curiosity about how I would feel about the task. It's like if I had a better idea, there was room in his mind for that to be expressed. He may choose to veto it, but he's not going to just automatically assume that I wouldn't have an opinion about it. He would respect me as a peer within the field and defer to me when he wanted advice about, hey, do you think that this is the best way to do this? If so, maybe you could do what I'm imagining that you should do. And he wasn't all shy. I mean, he's making eye contact and being a clear leader in clear command. But our mutual respect made it possible for there to be a teamwork dynamic where you almost felt like you were helping your friend do a project at their house, and they're gonna go out of their way to maintain friendliness and not singe the good feelings. They're gonna value you and appreciate you, and because of that, the work dynamics are gonna be, if you're an honest person, you're there to help. you're not just phoning it in, but you're serious about it, you're committed to it, then you harmonize and the job site is safer. It's more effective. That's why, I mean, we know that about training animals. There is no, as my understanding is that, and in my experience, it's all about positive reinforcement, not negative reinforcement. It takes wisdom to learn that. And we need to learn that as a, the geopolitics of the world need to understand and learn that. But that's, again, another story for another time. The point of me getting into this material is that if we are serious about, if I'm serious about tactical permaculture, meaning training, building, designing systems of organization so that permaculture projects can be deployed into dangerous areas. I've done my fair share of permaculture in very dangerous areas that I would call war zones. Civilian war zones is what I would call them. I mean, if you include law enforcement as civilians, which that's a bit of a nuance there. There's obviously military combat zones. There's paramilitary combat zones. There's places like Haiti right now where the war is mostly between and amongst civilians, but some of those civilians have come out of the military or law enforcement, and therefore they have superior tactical training and experience. But the war zones that I've done permaculture in would be places like South Central LA. That's probably where I've done the most of my East LA and South Central LA, where I was the white guy, or one of very few white guys, doing what a Green Beret would do to train up the Indige, to empower the locals to build resilience through permaculture design. And whatever percentage the real Green Berets, the percentage of their time spent training with automatic weapons and grenades and close quarter battle and all of the boom and bang stuff, a lot of it, to my knowledge, is about training leadership and organizing groups and figuring out how to sort out the skill sets of people and to help them build resilience beyond just the crudeness of violence, but on deeper levels. So for me, no, I was not hired by the state to train people to use gunpowder-based weaponry for the most part, but more a volunteer effort to bring ecological empowerment to folks in need who are living in a war zone. And it's interesting when people say Chicago has played a big role in my life as well, and I haven't done as much work out there, but I have, I guess, been on missions of delegation out there a number of times. I have very strong connections out there, or have had very strong connections over the years, if some of them faded for me at this stage of my life. But at my peak and my prime, Chicago was very one of the most powerful and potent parts of my network. Not my network, but the network that we shared. And it's interesting to hear veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars saying that comparing the body count, Chicago is a deadlier war zone than a lot of the places that U.S. soldiers were deployed in the Middle East. which is humbling and makes you think a lot about. There was one of my former Green Beret mentors, every chance he gets, pays respect to law enforcement officers, always saying the sort of sentiment that for soldiers, you know, you go out and you do your mission or you do your tour of duty and then you go home, you're still employed, you're still in the service, but you get rotations and you get breaks. But for, he says, for cops, for law enforcement, it's every day. And that's a whole career. It's not, you don't get a lot of rotations and breaks in your combat tours of duty. And sometimes, and oftentimes, that can be a more dangerous war zone to be in. And on top of that, you're not just trained to engage the enemy and basically kill anything that moves, for all intents and purposes, the way that war crimes are left unadjudicated. So he would say also that it's got to be a hell of a lot harder to be a cop, because most of what you do is restrain yourself from deadly force, whereas in the military, it's not carte blanche, or it's not supposed to be carte blanche, but in effect, in the heat of engagement in combat, that's what you're there to do, a job. And yeah, there's obviously rules of engagement and ways that policies will tie the arms of soldiers behind their backs and limit their maximum potential to do the job with force of violence. But that's an interesting nuance to think about. It's interesting to think about, wow, the urban drug warfare and even urban environmentalist warfare, ecological warfare, both of those wars I've fought in and over the course of my life, the nuance within those urban American drug and eco war zones, there's just a lot going on there. But that's sort of a digression to kind of round this to a close. I'll say I have a lot of confidence in the power of consensus decision making, the power of direct democracy, where if there's going to be a vote, it's going to be directly voted without delegates. The people who are affected by something, if they're going to agree to a majority rule, it's not going to be through any form of delegation. That would be direct democracy. So I'm a believer in that. I'm a believer in small groups, and I'm a believer in commanding without controlling. And I know that that is a social skill. There are times and places where barking orders is all you can do, because if the sound of, this is not my experience, but what I'm humbled by and what I'm aware of is the experience of soldiers in combat. Yeah, their commanding officer could be taken out, and then someone with very little or no experience has to replace them immediately. And people can barely hear each other. They've all got tinnitus if they can hear at all after all of the boom and bang. It would make sense in that context for the alpha people to take over and for them to be very unapologetic about having soft power. It has to be very direct, and I get that. Outside of that context, I think they also would acknowledge that in training and in skill development, the more tactful and respectful and flexible they can be as leaders, the more of that natural respect versus fear that they can generate. And then when it comes down to push and shove, their people, their team, their privates, whatever the case may be, they won't be filled with resentment and hostility and disdain. Another thing that one mentor, Green Brain mentor, said was that the commanders, they make it a point, whether by written rule or unwritten rule, not to hang out and not to get too close or spend a lot of time, not to recreate or party or go to the bar with their commandees, because all it takes is for you, the commander, to slip up once, to step out of line once, to break the rules, or to be unbecoming with your role, and then that will be, like I was saying earlier, that defines you. And whoever you're trying to command, if they know that you break the rules and you don't practice what you preach, and they see you let your hair down and get crazy, it's better they perceive you somewhat stoic and always exemplifying the highest standard. Because if you lose that, you lose everything as a commander, basically. And there's a place to fraternize, as it were. There's a place for relaxing and being social, of course. But I understand that as well. For me, it wouldn't be about not bonding and not being close to people. It is about bonding and being close, but definitely you set the standard. And if you are hypocritical, everyone is going to know that, because believe me, if you're the leader, whoever you're leading, whenever they get together and you're not around, they're all talking about you and how they feel about you. You know I do. One time I had an experience with a very, very extremely type A CEO founder who was just always in a frenzy. And he knew how to really get the most out of people, but he did it in a way where you wanted to impress, you wanted to deliver, you wanted to be the teacher's pet. You wanted to get the reward of having them be satisfied with your work. They knew how to reward, not just with money, but with acknowledgement and encouragement. So one time, you know, both of us, not like we would come in late or that we would sort of disobey our own policies. It was me and him at the very beginning of founding a company. Well, he was the founder. I came in later as an employee. I was about 24 at the time. But it was just that it became just the two of us running the business. So I had a lot of very close kind of, as they say, on the ground floor experience working with a very experienced executive who did work for Fortune 500s and knew how to raise venture funding and became very successful. And I was part of that in the very early stages. My music career is what I would say kept me from staying at that ground level with that company, because I'd have to go on tour and I'd have to kind of phase in and out of that company. But the point being, the story that I wanted to share about that employer was the fact that because we were the experienced sort of day-to-day keeping the ship afloat and moving in the right direction, we knew between the two of us what we could get away with that was kind of cutting corners on the policies. And it was okay because we kind of had that understanding that we wouldn't let things get too slacked up, or we would, you know, give each other some good graces and whatnot. I called him out before. I said, if this is my company, I would fire you right now for how you treated that customer. And he would tell that to venture capitalists who would come in and say, that's the kind of character that this guy has. You know, he's not afraid to call me out. That's how much he cares about what we're doing. And I did, and that's true. So we had that bond and that dynamic. We cared about the mission. And when a new employee came in, he didn't scold me, but he took me aside and he said, just make sure now that we have this new employee that you just shore up whatever you can think of that you might be doing that's kind of lax. Because I know you're only doing it because you know it's not a problem, you know, and you would make, it's not like a deficiency, it's just sort of things like, you know, the standard operating procedure by the book that we created says to do this thing this way, which, yeah, technically you can do it in 3 steps, but really you know that it should be done in 5 because 1 in 100 times if you did 4 out of the 5 steps or 3 out of the 5 steps, something's going to fail. And, you know, don't let those habits define what the new employee sees you do. You've got to take responsibility to realize you're going to set the standard for this person coming in. And however high you set the standard, it's always going to be slouched on to some degree. So it makes sense to kind of over, it's like saying, if you know someone is chronically late, you tell them to get there. You tell them that the event starts an hour earlier than it does, knowing that they'll show up an hour late and then they'll be on time. You know, I mean, there's an art to that, but, and it's not even cynical. It's just the way it is. It's comical, but I wouldn't say it's cynical. But that was, I remember that to this day. That's why I'm telling the story, you know. Whatever that sort of settling down into a slightly slouched position from the most erect posture that you could possibly have, doing things by the book that you even created, every time a new person comes into an organization, there's an opportunity for everyone to, even if it's not forever, but at least in the early stages, go, yeah, we salute each other, as it were, whatever that may mean. We check things off. We use the forms that we created, and we don't just skip over. I mean, there's so many ways. You ever go anywhere, and they'll have you breeze through very serious legal binding contractual agreements, and just, I mean, it's now as bad with all of the privacy policies that we don't read, but even renting something, or yeah, let's just say it's a rental, and they take you, they say, oh, you can skip that, and oh, you don't have to worry about that, and oh, I'll do that, and just let me do, and because you know a lot of what's on the form is formalities that don't always apply, so you just sort of get in that habit. So, yeah, I don't need to beleaguer this point, but I do feel like it's worth sharing to kind of wrap up on this concept of, without walking on eggshells or being too uptight, it's just interesting to think about leadership and the potential that we have to help people build confidence as members of your organization joining forces with you and your vision, to help them feel a strong bond and a strong sense of loyalty without being Kool-Aid drinking cult followers, but build them up to have a lot of pride and confidence in doing tasks where you set a high standard and you're very cautious about your demeanor. And then that flows downstream so that as an organization continues to grow, if that's the culture, that's the mentality, then yeah, then it can go from 95%, it can go from 95% adherence to doing things by the book and avoid dropping down to under 50%, which, yeah, there's a lot of, I remember, you know, documentaries about police departments where it's just dilapidated, everything's out of date, nothing works, it's totally corrupt, and that's terrifying to think about. It's terrifying to think about not just growing up in an underfunded school system, but being policed by not just underfunded. I don't want to get into the politics of that because there's a whole defund thing, which is a conversation I'm not going to have right now, but I mean, hey, look, the last thing I want is a police department that is underfunded such that their computer systems fail or chronically are falling offline and falling over and being hacked to where I don't get my speedy trial and I don't get my due process and I'm just rotting in a jail cell because they're underfunded. That is the unintended negative consequence of ideas like defunding the police. If anything, I would want more funding for them to be tactically trained by combat veterans of the elite units, because they're going to have better aim, they're going to shoot themselves and each other less, and they're going to shoot innocent bystanders less. That's something where I would be down for extra funding. Yeah. And there's going to be nuance about, yeah, how about less blank check surveillance and more training and upgrades to computer systems for security and for efficiency so that I can get my speedy trials and due process. And I will gladly pay those taxes and I'll be a cooperative, law-abiding citizen 10 times out of 10 when dealing with LEOs. But yeah, I think that is food for thought, and I hope you, the listener, can find ways to examine and sort of build an archive in your memory of the experiences you've had where you felt valued and honored and respected, and you needed less direction, or at least you earned the respect that was necessary for the direction you got to be much more respectful and therefore more effective. So if anything, yeah, we don't have, if the movements I came from haven't really accomplished much in the world, at least they'll always be a force of some form of influence towards sharing power with mutual respect. That's probably the way to put it. So with that said, cheers.